Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Later in this episode, we'll look back at the Great American Eclipse of 2017 with Dr. Gordon Telepin. A plastic surgeon, Telepin is one of the most passionate people I met last year in my many interviews with eclipse chasers. He designed a smartphone app called Solar Eclipse Timer that I found incredibly valuable in preparing for and experiencing the many amazing phenomena during a total eclipse, from strange animal behavior to weird lighting and shadows. But first, we're joined by our climate expert correspondent, Josh Willis. He's from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. I asked Josh to share with us his take on two NASA studies that give us an insight into what's happening and likely to happen with sea level rise due to the warming of our world. One indicates that sea level rise is not increasing at a steady rate, but is actually accelerating. The other describes new technologies and methods that are being used to help us understand the rate of motion and melting of massive glaciers in Antarctica. Warming oceans are accelerating the melting of ice on Greenland and in the southernmost continent, and also contributing to what could become catastrophic sea level rise in decades to come. Josh Willis, welcome once again to Blue Dot. I'd like to talk to you, Josh, about this new study I saw from JPL and NASA about sea level rise, that it's accelerating. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. So we've kind of known that sea level rise would accelerate. I mean, global warming is happening faster and faster. All the pieces are accelerating. But this new study actually finally detected it in our satellite observations of sea level rise from space.
I saw that they're talking about it doubling the amount of sea level rise we were expecting by 2100. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. You know, up until now, we've mostly just had wild guesses about what was going to happen in the future, because these ice sheets are, you know, we've never watched them disappear before. It's like we're doing an experiment for the first time. And so what this, what measuring this acceleration has given us is a sense of, you know, we knew that drawing a straight line from now to the end of the century, based on what's happened in the last 20 years, is probably too optimistic. But now we can draw more than just a straight line. We can actually see that the speed, the rate of the line, is increasing faster and faster each decade. And that's significant, because what it means is that the total amount of rise is going to be more by the end of the century. And it also means the rate that we have to deal with every decade is going to get higher and higher from here through the end of the century.
So if I've got my science right, what you're seeing is not so much as the slope of a line as a curve, which would indicate acceleration?
Exactly. So it's the change in slope. You know, another way to think about it is that in the early 90s, sea level was rising at sort of 2.5 millimeters per year, and now it's more like 3.5 millimeters per year. You know, the average over that whole time is about 3. But the fact is, you can see that what's happening now is faster than even what happened 20 or 25 years ago.
And of course, climate change is responsible for this. But is the melting of ice in what, Greenland and Antarctica, is that what's kind of causing this acceleration?
Yeah, we've been able to actually detect an acceleration in both Greenland and Antarctica using different satellite observations for some time now. So we've known that the contributors to sea level rise are accelerating. And now what we've finally seen is that the total is starting to feel the impact. So a big chunk, I forget exactly how much, if it's like 30% or a quarter or something like that, but a big chunk of the acceleration is actually attributable directly to Greenland.
And what about Antarctica's contribution? I saw another study today, I believe. Yeah, today in the news release from NASA, that a new study is showing that there's an acceleration of what's going on down in Antarctica. Did you get a chance to look at that?
Yeah, I did. And actually, the author is about three doors down the hall from me. So in that particular study, what they're actually looking at is how fast the ice is being evacuated off of the continent of Antarctica and back into the ocean. So if an ice sheet is stable over time, you get snow on the top and the middle, and then the ice itself literally flows like a liquid off of the land and back into the ocean. And if the two of those things are the same, if the snow added and the ice being evacuated out equal each other, then the ice sheet stays about the same, which is what it's done pretty much over the last 10,000 years until recently. And what they showed is that the evacuation rate of ice has actually increased in just the last 5 or 10 years. They can measure an actual increase in it. And it's about consistent with what we know in terms of the increased mass loss that we can see in Antarctica. So these satellites that we have weigh the continent, and we can tell that it's on a net losing mass. But this is actually telling us how. It's actually letting us know that it is the glaciers that are speeding up and spitting out ice faster into the ocean that are driving the rise.
Okay, you mentioned that the satellites are weighing the mass of ice. Could you explain to us how you do that from space?
Yeah, there's this pair of satellites called GRACE, and unfortunately, the first set just recently got decommissioned last year. Its successor is scheduled to launch in a few months. These two satellites chase each other around the planet. They're actually named Tom and Jerry. They chase each other around. And whenever the first one goes over something heavy, the pull of gravity causes it to speed up a little bit. And then when the second one follows, it catches up. And what they do is measure the distance between these two satellites very, very accurately. And by doing that, you can figure out the weight of the thing that you're flying over. And in this case, the thing that they were flying over was Antarctica. And you can tell it's losing mass.
Losing mass because the ice, as you said, evacuating or flowing off the continent.
Exactly. The ice is speeding up. And another thing that was really interesting in this paper is that a lot of the places that are speeding up appear to be places where the ice is interacting with the water. So in fact, a lot of this ice sits below sea level. It sits right in the ocean, and the oceans can warm it from below.
Well, and that's right in your wheelhouse, isn't it? Because you study how oceans melt ice.
Exactly. My mission is called Oceans Melting Greenland, OMG for short. Yes, I did pick the name when I was in a comedy class. But it's fitting because OMG, it's really surprising. And oceans melting Greenland is exactly what's happening. The waters surrounding the ice sheet are literally directly melting the ice that reaches the water and speeding up the evacuation of the glaciers into the ocean and driving sea levels higher and higher.
And so the ocean is doing the same thing down in Antarctica too.
Exactly. It's doing it especially on the peninsula, which sticks a little farther up north into the warmer parts of the ocean, but also a little bit upstream in West Antarctica. There are a couple of gigantic glaciers that empty out, and the warm currents appear to be beginning to reach these glaciers and eat away at the bottom, speed them up, break off these giant parts of the ice shelves there, and really are doing a number on the glaciers.
One of the takeaways I got from reading that story today too is that they're using a lot different methodology now than they did, say, back in just in 2011. That's really helped them understand this process. Could you explain, you know, how that's really advanced?
Yeah, they use imagery from lots of different photographs of the glaciers, and essentially you can track smudges and bumps and other things as they flow. So, you know, you take a picture on Monday, and then you take another picture on Wednesday, and you see that this one little speck right here has traveled by 20 or 30 meters or something like that. And you do that again and again and again in a bunch of different places, and you can piece together a picture for how the entire ice sheet is moving. And it's that motion and the fact that that motion is speeding up that's really one of the biggest concerns about sea level rise.
And so when we study these things from space, we also correlate them with, say, tidal gauge measurements, don't we?
That's right. Of course, you know, when it comes to sea level rise, what matters is the rise that's happening on your beach somewhere where you live. And to connect what's going on in the middle of the ocean and what's going on in distant places like Antarctica and Greenland, the tide gauges kind of help tie everything back to what really matters to people. And that's what's in my backyard.
And can somebody who lives on the beach or near the beach, can they really notice this change happening, like, say, over the last decade or two?
Well, yeah, you know, sometimes it's not super obvious, but what people start to experience first in areas that have are being impacted by sea level rise is what's called nuisance flooding. So if you stand on the beach, you know that waves roll in all the time. And if you live near the beach, you know that the tides are sometimes higher and sometimes lower. And if you live there for a year or two, you also know that every once in a while a big storm blows in, and that can raise sea levels too. And so all these things, what starts to happen is that over time, as the average oceans rise, then the high tide that didn't used to matter so much is now in your backyard, or the storm surge that would have passed you by is now emptying part of the Pacific into your backyard. So it's an increase in the frequency of those things that happens first. But of course, there's also erosion of beaches. There's intrusion of salty water into the freshwater supplies. And all of these things are impacts of sea level rise, and they've already started. Places like Miami are struggling with all of these things, New York, certain places on the West Coast too, that are low-lying near the beach. Flooding is becoming more common in San Francisco Bay, for example. What used to, the flood that used to happen only once every 100 years happens about once per decade now. So the infrastructure is really starting to feel the impact of this.
And so what's the next step in as far as monitoring this? You mentioned that there will be a new set of GRACE satellites. When do those go into operation?
Sometime later this year, they're supposed to launch. And the great news about GRACE is that even though the two satellite records don't overlap, the way the measurement works, we'll be able to kind of pick up right where we left off. And we'll be able to see, you know, the changes in mass in Greenland, even though we missed a couple of years or a few months, not even a couple of years. So I think what we're going to begin to see now is the clear acceleration in regions that are losing mass, and a more honed in picture of what's really happening right at the coast. You know, GRACE gives us kind of a blurry, fuzzy picture because it averages over a really big area. But studies like this, this new one, which came out today, they give us a really incredible detail. And the glaciers right at their edge are super complex. There's hundreds and hundreds of tiny little streams of ice that sometimes join together, sometimes split apart, and sometimes ones that are side by side act differently. And understanding all the reasons why is important if you really want to get the answer right in the long run. So I think in the coming few years, we're going to see more and more work that's showing, one, that the oceans are really important for what's going on with the ice, and two, a lot more detail about just what these glaciers are doing. So it's an exciting time for science, even though it's a little bit of a scary time for civilization.
What do you think we're going to, if you could project, you know, what you think we'll see in 2100? I'll probably be long gone by then. But what kind of changes will we see with what you think is happening now?
Well, I think we're going to see at least 3, but probably more like 6 feet of sea level rise. And the big question is, what are we going to decide to do in the next decade or two? I mean, if we decide to really revolutionize our energy consumption and move to a greener energy, then we might have avoided the biggest impacts. We might not be looking at all of the Greenland ice sheet melting in the long run. We might not be looking at more acidic oceans that are unable to sustain certain kinds of life. And so there's a big question. What are we going to do? And will we avoid the worst of the consequences? I certainly hope so.
Well, Josh, thanks for keeping an eye on this for us from space and from your office in Pasadena.
You bet. It's my pleasure, Dave. Anytime.
Thanks to our climate expert, Josh Willis. You are listening to Blue Dot from North State Public Radio. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll look back at the amazing experiences millions of Americans, including me, had during the total eclipse last August with Gordon Tullipin. Stay with us. Welcome back to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Next up, we're going to talk to Dr. Gordon Tullipin. He's the creator of the smartphone app Solar Eclipse Timer and was in many ways my personal coach for experiencing the total solar eclipse last August. He collaborates regularly with NASA scientists to help understand the many complex and dramatic phenomena associated with total solar eclipses, many of which are still not fully understood. He joins us via Skype from his home in Alabama. Gordon Tullipin, welcome to Blue Dot. You are the creator of the Solar Eclipse Timer, and that's how I got to know you last year. And I do want to say that app, that application on my smartphone, really did make all the difference for me in not missing anything during the eclipse.
Well, I appreciate that, Dave. That's why I developed it. And, you know, I always like to start off talking with you by thanking you for giving me the opportunity to be on your show. You know, I've looked at, listened to some of your other podcasts, and you have amazing people on your show. And you know, I just don't rise to the level of some of your guests. So I just appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, poo. I disagree. You know what? Of all the people that I've ever talked to about eclipses, and I've talked to some pretty amazing people, I can't think of anyone who's more enthusiastic about educating the public about eclipses than you are.
Well, I appreciate that. And that is exactly right. So let me start off by asking you a question. So last year, the reason we wanted to talk this month is this is the 6-month anniversary of the Great American Eclipse. And so it's just a nice kind of round number time to review things. So last summer, you talked to me and you talked to Fred Espenick and Mark Bender and Tyler. And I wanted to ask you, out of all of those discussions, and you talked to some, you know, really experienced people, did you think that it prepared you for the day? Did you know what to expect, or was the day much better than you could ever expected?
Gosh, that's a great question. I have to say yes and no. I felt very well prepared. Definitely the tutorials I got from you and using your app kind of helped me get ready for what I was going to experience. But I was so surprised at how dramatic it all was. You know, people had told me it would be like that, and I expected it to be, but it definitely was beyond my expectations. There were so many things that amazed me about it. And it's so hard, and I'm sure you've experienced this before too, that when you're talking to someone who has not experienced a total solar eclipse, they ask you questions like, well, yeah, so it just gets dark, right? And you're like, well, no, it's just so much more than that. It's this sensory overload of things happening that you've never experienced before. And it's just overwhelming. And I want to talk about some of those things as we go along. So I have to say, to answer your question as briefly as possible, it was better than I expected. The only complaint I have, which we all have, is it goes by so darn quickly that it's just like it's over so fast.
Oh, I agree. It was a wonderful eclipse, and I'm just so happy for the entire country. The way people prepared, and, you know, we had really good weather basically across the whole country. There were some storms in Missouri. There were some clouds at one section of Nashville. I know some people got clouded out, and there was some rainy weather in South Carolina. But for the most part, the weather cooperated across the country, so a lot of people got to enjoy the eclipse, and it's just wonderful. A wonderful day.
Well, one of my favorite things about the whole eclipse was listening to you tell me what to get ready for or what to be checking out. And I remember distinctly, because we were in a large field, and then there was a barn, and I was walking to the barn where all the porta potties were. It was about 300 people where I was at in Eastern Oregon. And I'm walking along, and I hear your voice because I got my phone with me, and it says, check for temperature change, be aware of temperature change. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way there's a temperature change yet. And I'm walking along, and then all of a sudden I go, it feels cooler. And I there was somebody nearby, and I said, does it feel cooler to you? And they said, yeah, I just noticed that. I thought it was just me. And I was like, no, I was amazed at how quickly the temperature changed.
That's a great observation. Because during an eclipse, so much is going on, and a lot of people are with a crowd like you were, and you tend to be a little distracted because you're with friends and families or even people you don't know enjoying the day. You do have to be nudged to be reminded to think about what's happening in your ambient surroundings. And one of those is certainly temperature. And that's one of the first things to change. So I've logged temperature data at eclipses. So I know when you can kind of start to feel it. I mean, and that's why the first announcement for temperature change is not 5 minutes after, first contact, because you're not going to feel it there. But, I waited long enough, about 45 minutes before C2, that's when the first announcement for ambient temperature change occurs, that I figured by that time people are going to be able to feel it if they think about it. And that's the whole point of the partial phase phenomena announcements in Solar Eclipse Timer, is to make people step back, take a moment, and think about it.
Well, it was funny because I found myself asking myself, it's like, wait a minute, are you just thinking the temperature changed because Gordon's telling you it's changing, or do you really feel this? And that's why I asked other people. I said, does it feel any different to you? And they said, yeah, it feels a little cooler. And I said, yeah, okay. And then I was amazed at how quickly that temperature dropped as you got towards totality. That just blew my mind.
It's amazing. Yeah. At my location, actually, I did a video on temperature logging. I actually messed up my data at this eclipse for temperature logging. And I talk in the video about my mistake. But somebody else who was logging temperature, although they didn't have a continuous log, they documented about a 12 degree Fahrenheit drop in the temperature at our site. And that's significant. I mean, you can feel that. And, the sun is so powerful, as you know. But this is almost linear. I mean, as the sun continues to get blocked, the energy from the sun continues to get blocked. And as more of a percentage gets covered, your temperature is going to fall. I mean, it just has to.
Well, and it's different from like when a cloud covers the sun or you go into the shadows. It's just it's a strange, like you said, it's linear. It's just this quickly sloping temperature drop that you've never experienced before. I never had anything like that I found quite amazing. And then the other thing, that I really appreciated was, you know, checking for the projections of the partially eclipsed sun through leaves and things like that, and taking people to go see that, because they were all out in a field where it was, you know, just there were no trees around. I said, no, let's come over here, look under these trees, look at the projections of this, of the sun, those little little crescent suns that were all over the place. And people just loved that.
Oh, it's great. That's a great thing. It's the pinhole projection concept. You can make little pinhole viewers if you want to, but then you can look for natural things that are making little pinholes. And if they're the right size and they're the right distance from the ground, they become in focus and you can see the crescents projected. It's wonderful. We did that at our site. We weren't with trees, but we made little custom pinhole projectors, you know, with our names in them. You can use a little paper hole punch and punch your name in it and hold it up and see your name reflected. I did one that said solar eclipse timer, just that I'll use, you know, for advertising at some point on my website. So I haven't done my video on pinhole projection, but I will, and we'll talk about the things like, so the next eclipse, if parents are bringing their children to the eclipse, I didn't do it for this one because I had so much gear as it was that I was bringing. But it's fun to just bring a colander. Bring a colander that you strain spaghetti with and hold it up and watch the colander make all the pinhole projections of the crescents. It's wonderful fun for a family. And I'll be doing a video on that.
Well, and I do know that a lot of my students and folks that live here in Northern California that were not in the eclipse path experienced those things. And they enjoyed that. And I got in some trouble with some of my family because, you know, they would say, oh, it was so cool, I really loved it. And I just like, no, you have no idea, because the difference between what you experienced and what I experienced with totality is literally totally different. It really is an amazing difference. The other thing that just boggled my mind was the strange lighting, especially as you got towards totality and as the shadow is approaching you. And you did an instructional video about this. I'd like you to talk about, because that felt like being in a science fiction film, where I literally felt like this is what it's like to be on a different planet, because I'd never seen anything like it. Like I said, it's not like a cloud going over the sun. It's not like overcast. It's very strange and eerie and just wonderful.
Dave, that is a really great observation, and you cannot explain that to anybody. As you just said, it is the weirdest lighting. You can only get that effect at an eclipse. So there's two things we should talk about with lighting. One is what you're referring to, which is the change in ambient lighting. And what's so interesting about this is as the penumbra is approaching and you're getting closer to the umbra, your eyes are adjusting. So, you know, your iris is opening and opening and opening until it can't open anymore. So you don't really perceive as much of a change as is probably really happening. And then, you know, the cones and the rods in the back of your eye start to fire on the black and white rods, I think it is. And then you compensate even more. But then right at the end, you just can't compensate anymore. And you really notice that this is a weird, weird lighting. There's two other things that happen. As you get to more black and white visualization, you start to have less depth color. So everything starts to take on a little gray, blue, or silver hue. So that changes how you're perceiving your surroundings. And then the other thing is, as the sun gets covered and you get more to the limb of the sun, the wavelengths of the colors that get projected by the sun change a little bit. So that's another thing that affects the way you see the colors in the lighting in your immediate area, the ambient lighting, when you get within that in that last 3 to 5 minutes of the eclipse is when your eyes really can't adjust anymore. And you see the difference. And that's it's an amazing thing. You just can't explain that. There's no other place that you can see that kind of lighting change happen right around you in that small amount of time. It's incredible.
Yeah. And like I said, it's not just the lighting, it's the feeling of the temperature change. It's so many things happening to all of your senses at once that it's just overwhelming. And I saw people with tears in their eyes, and they weren't sad or anything. They're just getting their senses overwhelmed. Can you just back up a little bit and define for some of our listeners what you mean by penumbra and umbra?
Oh, sure. So anytime the, well, actually even on Earth, and I have a video on this, when something casts a shadow, so when the moon casts a shadow on the Earth, there's the direct shadow, the direct lines of light, which are making the umbra. And then there's the infinite amount of crossing amounts of light around the moon that are crossing from left to right and right to left and back and forth all the way around, infinite numbers of rays of light that create the penumbra. And that's the, you know, the less shady part of the eclipse, which actually the beginning of the penumbra really marks C1. And then as the penumbra gets deeper and deeper and deeper, because it gets darker and darker and darker as it gets close to the umbra, the real shadow of the moon, that's when you're approaching C2.
You're listening to Blue Dot from North State Public Radio in Northern California. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll return to our conversation with eclipse chaser and educator Gordon Telepin. Stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom. Welcome back to Blue Dot from North State Public Radio in beautiful Northern California. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Gordon Telepin. Gordon is a plastic surgeon and passionate observer and educator for all things related to total solar eclipses. His YouTube channel is titled for his smartphone app, Solar Eclipse Timer. Another thing I'd like you to tell me, explain about is the shadows got so strangely delineated and sharp. Much different looking than shadows. And then I also noticed during the annular eclipse, was that in 2012?
I don't know when you saw your annular.
It was the one here in the United States, but I think it was 2012. But regardless, I remember like this, the weird projections of like your hands making strange, like it looked like you had long fingernails. There's weird shadow projections. And then all of a sudden during this eclipse, I saw the shadows getting this weird sharpness to them that I'd never seen before.
Great observation. And so this eclipse, I love that phenomena. The phenomena, I call it the phenomena of sharp and fuzzy shadows. There is very, very little information on the internet about it. As far as I can tell, and I've searched a lot, nobody has really documented it well. So it was one of my challenges was to do an experiment at this eclipse and try to document it. So I thought up a little experiment to try to do it and practiced it at home. You know, that's the thing about eclipses. There's no way to practice because the eclipse is unique. And so you can kind of think what you're going to do, but you don't really know if it's going to work on eclipse day. But anyway, I went to the eclipse site with my little contraption, which was basically three commercial paint sticks. And to do the experiment, you have to line them up with a plan. And so the horizontal stick was lined up in the axis of the path. And then 90 degrees to that, there was a stick pointing upward. So if you're 90 degrees to the path with an overhead eclipse, that means you're parallel with the crescents. So the vertical stick was parallel with the crescents. And then I had kind of a control that just went out at 45 degrees between those two sticks at 90 degrees. And my experiment worked perfectly, Dave. It showed exactly what I wanted to do. So here's what happens in general. When you're under the sun on a normal day, you're in under a big globe of light with infinite amounts of light rays, you know, casting the shadow. And if you could get your hand to the ground in focus, there's a point where you can have a penumbra and an umbra because there's direct rays and there's crossing rays. So that's called an extended source of light when there's just infinite amounts of rays of light in all different directions. But what happens during an eclipse, as the sun is getting blocked and the sun is becoming more and more of a crescent, things change. So what happens is the light directions to the Earth become more linear. So things that are casting a shadow that are in line with the crescent make sharp edges to their shadow. Things that are 90 degrees to the crescent are basically still seeing the crescent as an extended source of light, so their shadows stay fuzzy. This is the only time on Earth that you can see this happen basically in real time, shadows changing. So this was a great eclipse for it because at my observing site, which was on the center line with the sun at about 62 degrees in the sky, it was very high in the sky, I could set up my little experiment to cast shadows down on a white sheet, and it worked perfectly. At the beginning of the eclipse, the vertical and horizontal stick were fuzzy shadows. And then I took pictures of the shadows at about halfway between C2 and C1 and C2. And the vertical stick gets sharp shadows because it is in line with the crescent. And the horizontal stick stays fuzzy just like it's supposed to happen. Now, I had a lot going on at this eclipse, so I didn't take more pictures of that experiment. In the future, I'd like to do it again with a time-lapse camera just kind of set on automatic to automatically just take the picture so I can document it deeper into the partial phases. But the experiment worked, and I have a video about it on my YouTube channel. And I believe I have the best video on the internet documenting that really poorly documented partial phase phenomena up to this point. I'm really excited about that experiment.
Well, I think anybody that it would be interested in, like, for example, traveling to South America for the 2019 eclipse or the one that we'll talk about later here in the United States in 2024, would really be smart to watch as many of your videos as they possibly can, because they really do prepare you to be able to understand and see so many more things than if you just go out and say, okay, we're going to an eclipse. I want to make sure we understand, you know, so C1 is that first contact with the moon, and then C2 is, that is the moment when?
That's the moment when the moon completely obscures the sun and you go into totality, and it's safe to remove your solar glasses and look at the corona with your eyes. And then C3 is the end of that point. That's when the moon is going to move off of the sun and the sun will peek out on the other side, and it gets very bright very quickly, as you experienced. Have to put your glasses back on. And then C4 becomes the end of the eclipse, where the moon moves completely off the sun and the eclipse is over. And as you saw, you know, C1 to C4 takes over 3 hours for most eclipses, where C2 to C3, you know, the part that we all wait for, was, you know, maximum time for this last eclipse was 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Yeah, it was about 2 minutes for me, and probably the fastest 2 minutes of my entire life.
Right.
One of the things that was really wonderful was, you know, to experience this with a crowd of people nearby. The diamond ring effect is so powerful and beautiful when that happens. It's just, it creates this sense of just joy. And you could hear that in the response of the crowds where I was, where they just were like, oh, you could just hear this, you know, it's like being at a sporting event, only, you know, had a more of a, I don't know, kind of a spiritual tone to it rather than, you know, yeah, we just slam dunked on our least favorite team.
Sure. I understand. That's a beautiful part of the eclipse. For me, in the eclipses I've seen in the past, and this one too, although this one I looked at the diamond ring going in a little bit more, you know, even though I have to tell people not to do that, I see that little last little flash. To me, it looks like a little flash all around me, like a little subtle flash bulb, and then all of a sudden it gets dark. You know, I had to be careful about that with Solar Eclipse Timer for this eclipse and make sure that I was conservative with the glasses off announcement and the glasses back on announcement. You kind of have to lead it a little bit on the glasses on, because again, I was really concerned about, you know, eye safety. The other thing is, you've probably read about the difference in the fact that the lunar limb can affect the actual point of C2 and C3 for this eclipse, maybe up to about 3 seconds. So there's people who can get their diamond ring 3 seconds earlier or 3 seconds later. So I had to kind of fudge that into my glasses announcement to make sure that things were safe. But yeah, watching the diamond ring, if you know how to do it and do it safely, is fun. You probably should not do it magnified, you know, through a telescope or binoculars, but doing naked eye is probably safe.
No, but the next thing that was so beautiful, and my I was with my brother-in-law, and he's very you know, a hunter, fisherman, not a big science guy, and he was just overwhelmed by the beauty of the corona. In fact, for hours afterwards, he would be asking me things like, "Do you remember that one streamer at 3 o'clock or whatever?" And I was just, "Yeah, well, that was pretty awesome." He just was enthralled by the corona.
That is an amazing part of the eclipse. This eclipse had a beautiful corona. Those streamers were beautiful. I haven't really had time to process, you know, my photography, but that was a beautiful corona. And the other thing is, you know, Dave, you're an astronomer. One of the amazing things about an eclipse, and think about this, there is nothing you can do in astronomy that has something in the sky that you're looking at, especially naked eye, that is that large and that dramatic. You know, you can look at a moon, a full moon, but that's big. But it's not as big as the corona around the eclipse sun. There is nothing we can look at that's that huge in terms of, you know, angular diameter in the sky. That's why it's so overwhelming, you know, to people. It's just a beautiful thing to see it in the sky kind of pulsating in the atmosphere. It's like it's alive.
Yeah, it is. It's moving, and literally and figuratively. And it's also, it's a color that I can't describe. I've never seen that color. You could call it a silvery color, whatever you call it. You whatever words you try to use to describe it are just don't do it any justice at all.
No, our eyes are so wonderful. To see, to be able to distinguish that color and the subtle vibration in it, or the movement in it, and the dynamic range, and see it in real time with your friends and everybody getting excited about it. There's just nothing like it.
Well, I'd also like to talk about something that it was very interesting to hear about, because I was in a unit of the National Park Service at John Day Fossil Beds National Monument. And the next day I got the chance to talk to the superintendent of the park and some of the park rangers. And they really had some interesting experiences with animal behavior, watching birds go to roost and things like that. So could you tell us a little bit about that? Because that was something that you said to observe. Where I was, there wasn't a lot of dramatic animal behavior. But I heard from a lot of other people that were in places maybe quieter where they could hear, you know, the birds and the insects and things. Talk about the animal behaviors that change during an eclipse.
Animal behavior is an amazing thing. So most people will be in a situation in a natural environment where you'll be able to hear crickets go crazy during an eclipse. I heard them go crazy at my first eclipse in 2001 because we were right next to kind of a mowed down hayfield. So there were a lot of crickets. At the site for this eclipse, when we showed up, there were crickets there. We were kind of on a hilltop in a vineyard. But by the time all the people arrived, all the crickets were chased away, you know, to the hedgerows that were far away from us. So we didn't have natural sounds of crickets going crazy during the eclipse, which is really fun to hear. The other things you have to kind of be in a position to look for. So, you know, I did a video on chicken behavior. We'll talk about that. You know, they say that grazing animals will stop grazing, but you would have to be at a farm and, you know, want to be looking for that. So I think most of the time, and people will not necessarily be in a position if they're watching the eclipse to be next to the woods to see if birds are really going to go up into the trees, you know, to roost. So one of the ways you can try to document animal behavior is to try to take videos of chickens. And I wanted to do that for this eclipse. I knew I wanted to do it. And I was lucky that one of my sites for this eclipse was actually in Nashville. I did a site visit to a friend of a friend who was in Nashville, and their neighbor had a chicken coop and chickens. So I asked the lady who runs that farm if I sent her all the gear all set up, would she place a video camera on the chicken coop to see what the chickens did, because they were right in the path of totality. They had about a 2-minute and 1-second totality in their area of Nashville. So she agreed to do it. And so a lot of people videoed chickens for this eclipse, but I was really lucky that this lady who I contacted this farm put her mom in charge of running my little video camera. So I didn't know the setup for this chicken coop at all. And so I just told him, look, point the camera at the chicken coop where the door is, and I want to see if it, as it gets darker, if the chickens are going to go in, if they think it's nighttime. Well, luckily, they had somebody monitoring the camera, and you'll see in the video online that lady moves the camera towards the feeding troughs. So I didn't know anything about these feeding troughs for these chickens. I didn't know anything about their behavior under normal circumstances, under a normal day, until I talked to the lady after the eclipse. So this is really funny. I sent her a little Kodak PlaySport. Basically, you just had to power it up and turn it on. They didn't have to do anything else. They didn't have to focus it. They didn't have to do anything. Just had to line up the chicken coop. So I sent her in a UPS on a tripod, all ready to go. And then I sent her, you know, a return, paid for return label. After the eclipse, she shipped it back to me. I got it in my office. So I'm looking at this little video. It's about 20 minutes of chickens because they videoed before and after totality. And I get to totality and the chickens weren't going into the coop. I mean, I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I'm in the office watching it.
You had predicted that you thought the chickens are going to go into their coop to roost.
Absolutely. So you think that birds want to get, nighttime is coming. They have a natural instinct to avoid predators, and they want to get into their protective area, whether or not it's chickens on a farm in a coop or birds out in the wild getting up onto a higher branch. But they didn't do it. So I'm watching the video, but I see this other behavior. I see that they go to the troughs to feed when it gets light. So I said, I don't know what's going on here, but they did something. So I call the lady up and I said, tell me about your chickens. They didn't go into the coop when it got dark, but they did something. And I explain it in the video. And that's when she tells me their normal routine. She had a bet with her husband that the chickens wouldn't go into the coop because she knows her chickens. She knows that they hang out after it gets dark under a normal day, on a normal day for 30 or 40 minutes. But the routine is at night when it gets dark and the chickens do go into the coop, they close the doors to protect them for the night. Then in the morning, the sun goes out and he puts fresh feed in those troughs, those feeding troughs, and then he opens the door. And so the chickens come out and they eat breakfast. So the wonderful thing about my video, Dave, this is amazing. The chickens on eclipse day during totality did not have the cue of the door opening for breakfast. They only had the cue of it getting light again. So the single cue of it getting light again made them go to the troughs and feed. So it's just an amazing documentation of animal behavior. I was extremely lucky to get it because, as I said, my friend of a friend had her mom monitoring this camera and moved it, because if they just followed my instructions, I never would have had that video, because they just would have sat the camera looking at the chicken coop and never would have panned over to those feeding troughs. So with their help and a little bit by accident, although I kind of tried to pre-plan from, you know, for some animal behavior, I have one of the best animal behavior, you know, videos on the internet that was absolutely fascinating to me.
Well, we're rapidly running out of time, which I knew we would be. But before we let you go, I want you to let us know, give us a preview of the next great American eclipse as briefly as you can in 2024. Where is that path going to be?
Sure. So 2024, it's April 8th, 2024. It'll be coming up through Mexico and crossing all of Tennessee, Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, New York State, and going out Vermont and Maine. So it's a great eclipse, and it's longer too, Dave. You have to get down to Texas. In Texas, it'll be about 4 minutes and 26 seconds. So almost two times as long as you had in Oregon.
Wow. And the one piece of advice I would give everyone is do not wait to start planning for this, because I tried to reserve places a year in advance and started calling around in Oregon. It's like, no, it's been booked for years. So you need to start planning now for 2024.
Absolutely, you do. And I've booked for 2019 in Argentina already. I mean, I'm ready.
Well, Gordon, I have to say, of all the people that I've talked to, they're all wonderful, but nobody really has more passion. I'm not going to say that you have more than anybody else, or they don't have as much as you, but nobody I know has more passion than you do for sharing your love of eclipses with all of us.
Well, Dave, I appreciate that. And again, I appreciate the opportunity. And my YouTube channel, which is called Solar Eclipse Timer, is where I'm going to be posting all of this educational information in a video format, which is easy for people to absorb. And I'm going to keep on working it.
Thanks once again to our climate expert correspondent, Josh Willis, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and our guest, creator of the smartphone app Solar Eclipse Timer and eclipse educator, Gordon Telepin. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcasts at NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.